Hey, check it out, y'all. This is A.D. Haddon, Cowboy World. Get ready for Western World Radio on 90.1 KPFT Houston, Wednesday evenings at 6 p.m.
Hi, this is August. You're listening to Pan-African Journal. This is KPFT Houston. Stay tuned.
This is Gerald Horn, historian, activist. I listen to Pan-African Journal on KPFT in Houston, and I hope you do too.
Tonight, we have a special program for you, produced by our sister station, WPFW. Up next is Tony Browder of the Browder Files with Amplify Sudan, a program that ran all day, again on our sister station, WPFW, to amplify the history, the culture, the economic diversity, and the historical context of what we see now and what we're hearing of the Sudan conflict. Tony Browder, however, goes back to when Sudan was called Kush. So again, this is a special program, and I hope that you gain a lot of insight to the history of Sudan so that you can understand why they're having conflict now in this very rich nation. I'm Akua Holt. Stay tuned for more of Amplify Sudan on Pan-African Journal, KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM.
I'm from Sudan. You know Sudan?
You're listening to Amplify Sudan on
KPFT Houston.
Let your spirit run free along your Black Nile. Hey, take my hand and see creation's plan along your Black Nile. My ancestry and history is calling me. Come on, let's see, hey, just how it used to be. Hey, come along with me. Let your spirit run free along your Black Nile.
Good afternoon. Welcome to another edition of the Browder Files Show. We're here to talk about the Black Nile, which has its origins in Equatorial Africa, flows out of Uganda, flows out of Ethiopia. The two rivers, the White Nile and the Blue Nile, come together in Sudan and form the singular Nile River, which continues its journey through Sudan and into the entire nation of Egypt and empties into the Mediterranean Sea. It's all the Black Nile. And because today's programming here at
KPFT
is about the amplification of Sudan, we're going to do our part to tell the story of Sudan. We're not going to talk about Sudan under conflict. We want to go back. We want to go way back and talk about Sudan as one of the oldest civilizations ever recorded. We want to talk about why Sudan is so important. It's been marginalized. We hear about conflicts in other parts of the world, conflicts in the Middle East, conflicts in Europe, but people have a tendency to disregard conflicts in Africa. So today's program, Amplify Sudan, is critically important because it puts the focus where the focus should be on us, on our people, on issues that matter to us. Since this day is devoted to the amplification of Sudan and discussing not just the conflict in Sudan, the two-year conflict in Sudan, but also the history of Kush before it became Sudan. So you can go to the YouTube channel after this day of programming is over, because after me, we're going to have Eugenia Charles discuss Sudanese refugees. We're going to have Donald Temple with his Loveology show, and he's going to have a Sudanese reporter, I think the co-producer of this Amplify Sudan programming is going to be his guest. And then Jordan Strudwick will be on with the Blue Notes for Sudan. So there will be a full day of programming for Sudan. And just take note of any other activities you want to engage in after you have fully immersed yourself in more knowledge about Sudan, why it's important, and find ways that we can begin to increase awareness about the atrocities that are committed in Sudan. Today's Amplify Sudan programming, I'm pleased to invite two guests. These guests are scholars and experts in their related fields. What's good about my guests today, Amoye Niblett and Amadeus Christ, what's good about my two guests is that I've known them for several years. We've traveled to Egypt together, and we also traveled to Sudan together. We were blessed to travel to Sudan in July of 2016 with Renoka Rashidi. So we can give you some firsthand views on why Sudan is important. And what my objective is this evening is to follow up on some of the comments that were made by the guests in the previous show on Sophie's Parlor. Sister Nadia, who is Sudanese, talked about her country, talked about her hometown and how hospitable the people in Sudan are. She talked about the fact that Sudan is one of the oldest documented civilizations on the planet. There are aspects of ancient Sudanese history, or I like to refer to it as ancient Kushite history, because Sudan, as we should know, is an Arabic word that refers to the black people of that country. But Kush is the indigenous term for that country when it was ruled by indigenous Africans. And I'm always respectful of the importance of referring to people and the lands that indigenous people use to refer to their land. So you hear me oftentimes talk about Kemet, which is the country that we now call Egypt. But it's about being respectful of those who lived and died in the lands, and also talking about and respecting the legacy that we have inherited. The war in Sudan has captured a lot of attention, and I'm not going to go into many of the statistics about the war and the casualties of the war. You've heard that on the other shows that air during today's Amplify Sudan programming. But I do want to share with you a quote from a reporter. I believe it was a French reporter who was describing some of the atrocities in Sudan. He said that the war in Sudan is destroying not just the country's future, but also the country's past. And in that context, I was taken when I heard about the destruction of the Sudanese National Museum, the looting of the museum. It was in April of 2023 that the rebels, the RSF paramilitary forces, took control of Khartoum, the capital of Sudan, and they raided the Sudan National Museum, which contains over 100,000 artifacts. And from what I've read and reports that I've gotten from colleagues of mine who I have worked with in Egypt and who also do archaeological work in Sudan, they said that the museum was totally destroyed. And according to reports, 90% of the 100,000 artifacts are gone or have been destroyed. We're talking about priceless items of gold and jewelry and pottery and mummies and sarcophagi were destroyed or are missing. And the artifacts that are missing are believed to have been smuggled out of the country, sold to art collectors and museum collectors from Europe and other parts of the world. And these items have been stolen and sold in order to finance the war, in order to buy more rifles, buy more ammunition, buy more missiles and drones and things of that nature. So this is a tragedy on multiple levels. I've also read that the RSF forces have raided archaeological sites, the sites near Meroweh, a crucial center of ancient Kushite history and culture. Historic buildings within Khartoum have been damaged during the fightings. And the damage of these buildings is probably permanent. If Sudan ever recovers from this conflict, these buildings will probably never be restored because the priority of the country is to care for its people. And I get that. I understand that. So I can't even begin to imagine all of the objects that will be lost forever. And another important fact is that within the past decade, the Sudanese government has been amping up the training of their archaeologists, the training of museum staff and other professionals who have begun to take the lead in doing this archaeological research. Most of the people who do excavations in Sudan are foreigners from Europe, from America, from South America. There are very few Sudanese actively involved in this work. So a generation of people have lost the opportunity to ply their skills. So this war is impacting this nation on so many different levels. And so my guests today are going to help us talk about what has been lost and what we can do to acknowledge the loss and how we can hold on to memories of things that have been lost. And possibly there may be some opportunities for us to discuss what we can do to preserve what remains. So again, my guests today are Amoye Niblett, who is the author of a new book called Nswit Biti, The Spirits of Our Ancestors, the Indigenous Black Rulers of Egypt. And hopefully we'll also talk about the Indigenous Black Rulers of Kush or Sudan as well. And my other guest is filmmaker Amadeus Christ, who's done three films about history of Nile Valley, history of Africa. And within these films is some incredible footage that he was able to capture during his trip to Sudan and Egypt. So, brothers, welcome to the Browderfile Show. How are you?
Great, great.
Excellent, excellent. Thank you for having us.
All right, it's my pleasure. And, Brother Amoye, I'd like for you to set the tone in us talking about the ancestors in the Nile Valley, the Kushite ancestors in the Nile Valley, by offering a verbal libation, if you will, a tribute, acknowledgement to these ancestors.
Yes, of course. Hotep Dinasu Wasir Nebzudu, Metje Ea Neb Abzu, Neb Nehehe, Hotep Impu, Kentisha Nefer Tep Juef, Hotep Amun, the Hidden One, Amun Asher Renu, the Self-Created One. Disanu Parek Karu Tahenke, Kakao Ka Apatu, Ka Sheshu, Ka Menkatu, Ka Sinetja, Ka Meket, Ket Mbet, Neferet, Wabet Didet Pet Kima Ta Inet Hapi, Hunk Ench Netcher In, Imaki Amanarenus, Maakuru, Inka In Imaki Pianki, Maakuru, Inka In Imaki, Amana Shiketo Ma'akuru, Inka in Shabaka Ma'akuru, Inka in Imaki Amana Tore Ma'akuru, Inka in Tahaka Ma'akuru, Inka in Imaki Naheka Ma'akuru, Inka in Imaki Tarakamun Ma'akuru, Wa Neturu. That is a voice offering that is a very old offering that you see in the tombs of Kemet and also in Kush Nubia. That gives it's like how we do in the rest of Africa when we give a libation, a This is a voice offering that feeds the spirits, the ka of these ancestors. And we welcome their presence here in this meeting today.
Thank you for that offering, my brother. So the language you were speaking is commonly referred to as Medu Neter, or what the Greeks call hieroglyphics. What do you know? What can you tell our listeners about the origins of that text, hieroglyphics?
Well, it's a language that was indigenous. It came out of the Nile Valley. We don't know exactly the point where it was created, but it started around 3100 BC, thereabouts, maybe a little earlier. And it's a very interesting language. Now, the people in Kush also was able to communicate in that language, although they had different languages as well, because the kingdom of Kush, just like the kingdoms of Kemet, consisted of lots of different ethnic groups of Africans. So the Medu Neter was spoken by the Kushites as well as the Kemites.
Mm-hmm. I want to also just share with our listeners, particularly those who live in the Washington, D.C. community, or anyone who will be traveling to D.C. in the near future, I would encourage you to go to the Smithsonian Museum of Natural History, which is a couple of blocks east of the National Museum of African American History and Culture. All of the museums, Smithsonian museums, are now open since the government shutdown has ended. In the Smithsonian Museum of Natural History, there is a room that focuses on Africa specifically, West Africa and East Africa. And in that room, as soon as you walk into that room, you'll see on the right side a display about Kemet, ancient Egypt. And on the left side, you'll see a display about Kush. And what's important to note is that there are a couple of passages from noted Kemetic and Cushitic scholars who state that the history of Kush is as old as Kemet. Both nations developed around the same time. So we're looking about 3100, 3200 BC. They became nation states. But after Kemet fell and was no longer ruled by indigenous Africans, and that was about 325 BC, after Kemet fell, Kush became an independent or remained an independent African nation for almost an additional 1,000 years. So in that context, the history of Kush or ancient Nubia or ancient Sudan parallels that of Kemet and is older, lasted longer than that of Kemet. So why don't we know this? Why isn't the average person aware that this history is as grand as that of ancient Egypt, which everyone freely and openly talks about?
You're listening to Tony Browder of the Browder Files, straight from a series of programs that ran on our sister station, WPFW, entitled Amplify Sudan. These programs highlighted some of the issues and challenges that Sudan is having today. I'm Akua Holt. Stay tuned for more of Amplify Sudan on Pan-African Journal, KPFT, Houston.
I'm from Sudan. You know Sudan?
You're listening to Amplify Sudan on
KPFT, Houston.
Let your spirit run free along your black Nile. Hey, take my hand and see creation's plan along your black Nile. My ancestry and history is calling me. Come on, let's see. Hey, just how it used to be. Hey,
come along with me. Let your spirit run free along the old Black Nile.
You're listening to Tony Browder of the Browder Files. I'm Akua Holt. Stay tuned for more of Amplify Sudan on Pan-African Journal, KPFT, Houston.
First of all, the Europeans, when they discovered ancient Kemet and Champollion, the Metal Metro, was able to read the hieroglyphic language, of course, the narrative that they tried to create was that Kemet was not an African civilization, that it was, according to James Henry Breasted, it was created by the great white race that came from, he drew a circle around Africa and Europe and said that the great white race had descended into Kemet and created the civilization.
Yeah, Breasted was also responsible for coining the phrase dark-skinned Caucasians.
Which was very strange, because if this great white race came into Africa and civilized, brought this civilization, they didn't have it where they came from.
Mm-hmm.
Then, as this narrative started to, they tried to make traction with it, they came up with that great that thing about the dark-skinned Caucasians that created the civilization. But, you know, they tried to separate Egypt from Africa, basically. And so the narrative was that none of this stuff had to do anything to do with Africa. And that the Kushite, which the history, as you pointed out, was around the same. I mean, you go back to the A group of what Weisner called the A group, which is also an idiotic kind of notation to give people. He called them the A group and the C group. But these were early Kushites people that lived, their culture is just as old as Kemet. As a matter of fact, some of the iconography of the early kings came from the south in Kush. So, you know, there was a mingling of the cultures. These people coexist. They traded together. They lived together. They fought each other at times. And but the history, to go back to your question, the history was separated between Kemet and Kush, because they tried to push Kemet as a white civilization. And they conceded that Nubia, since it was so farther south, was an African, indigenous African civilization. Then later on, when you open up and you talked about the destruction, it just really hit my heart. It was devastating, because I didn't know all of the details of that. But that's very similar to what happened when they constructed the Aswan Dam. And they destroyed a lot of the history of Kush was destroyed. It's laying under in the water in the Aswan Dam. You know, I mean, thousands of years of history was lost. Temples, tombs, and more importantly, people's homes, they were uprooted and they had to be scattered to different places. And all of that history was gone.
Exactly.
And then, the Kushites themselves, they had their own language. And, you know, since the Egyptologists didn't think that Kush was worth studying, they didn't decipher any of the languages there. They only focused on the Metal Metro that the Kushites had spoken, you know. And so there's no permanent records of that area about their history other than what the Kenites wrote about it.
Sure. And, you know, you mentioned a couple of things that I want to comment on, and then I'll bring Brother Amadeus into the conversation to talk about his work. You mentioned George Reisner, who was with the Boston Museum of Fine Arts and Harvard University. Reisner was the first European of note, person of European ancestry of note, to go in and explore Kush or ancient Sudan. And he became one of the foremost authorities. And when he found the remains of temples and tombs and monuments, he stated, Reisner stated, this Harvard professor stated that the artifacts that he found in Kush in Sudan were too fine to have been crafted by Negroes. So he advanced this notion that it had to be a race of outsiders who came in and conquered the land and built all of these artifacts. So this idea of taking African greatness out of Africa leads to the work that you've been doing, Brother Amadeus, with your films, Out of Darkness. You know, Africa was referred to as the dark continent. And so your three films, the title of your three films addresses this issue of taking Africa out of darkness. What was the impetus behind you using these names in the titles and subtitles of your three documentaries?
Yeah, well, I came into this knowledge not as a historian or an archaeologist or anthropologist. I came into this knowledge strictly from a filmmaker standpoint. I was not introduced to any of this information as a young person, I'm sure as many other young Black men are. I was taught that our history began with slavery, even though as a kid, I always had a strong connection and a fascination with Egypt. I remember in sixth grade, we had to pick a project to do, a book report, and I picked Egypt. Little did I know that I would end up there later on in my life. But I was just always fascinated with Egypt, the history of it. I didn't know that Egypt was the cradle of civilization. I always thought that was, you know, the Greeks. They taught us about Rome and Greece, but never Egypt. And I thought that was very peculiar. I didn't know that Egypt, you know, was the birthplace of math, science, medicine, astronomy, architecture, spiritual systems, and even writing. So, I always say that I came into film almost by accident. I was always very fond of movies. In fact, that was one of my fondest memories of being with my father, is that we would always watch movies. So I kind of got the film language implanted in me at an early age. I had a brief stint in music, and that kind of segued into me doing music videos. After a while, I got frustrated with the music industry and decided that I wanted to kind of use my talents for positive and to help my people and to showcase who we are, who we were. I originally was going to just do a film about the effects of slavery, but when I started to get into where we were before slavery, that's when I went down a rabbit hole and I figured out how much of our history had been hidden from us, going all the way back to, you know, 7,500 BC. And I decided, you know, I have to bring this to light. I have to bring or at least help to bring our people out of darkness. And that's what I did. My first film, Out of Darkness, was released in 2015, largely spearheaded by by you, Mr. Browder, after meeting you at Pan African City Alive. When I did the first Out of Darkness, I hadn't gone to Egypt yet. This was 2015, 2016. You granted me the opportunity to actually to go to Kemet, where we ended up spending 2 weeks there, a week at your site over in South Asasif, and then a week in Sudan. And as a filmmaker and actually taking this pilgrimage, this holy pilgrimage that I like to call it, for the first time and actually seeing all of this stuff with my own eyes and being blown away by the scope of it, the size of it, blew me away. So that led me to do the two follow-up films, Heavy is the Crown, Volume 1 and Volume 2, with all of the footage that I captured while in Egypt during that trip, 2016.
You're listening to the voice of Amadeus Christ, filmmaker. You heard previously from Amoye Niblett, a comedic scholar who has a new publication out, which he'll talk about in a few minutes. And you're listening to the Browder Files show, our contribution to WPFW's all-day programming, Amplify Sudan. So let me ask both of y'all, since we had the pleasure, we had the honor of traveling to Sudan together with the late, great Dr. Rinoco Rashidi. Let me ask each of you to share with our audience what that experience was like traveling through Sudan. So Moya, you're the elder, so I'll defer to you.
So the destruction of the antiquities and the Sudanese museum is compounded by what was lost 65 years ago with the construction of the Aswan Dam. But there's a blessing sometimes in where you least expect to find it. On that trip that we made to Sudan, I had the fortune of watching Brother Amadeus at work. Actually, before we did that, it really piqued my interest when we were at Medinet Habu, which was a place that it's a huge temple that to me rivals Ipet Sut, the Karnak temple. That it was such a beautiful place. And I watched him as I was taking pictures. I just watched him work, taking all of this footage, all of this film that he was of all of the stuff that was in this huge temple. And then when we got to Sudan, he was doing the same thing. I mean, he just spent time in the desert. He was going all over the place, taking still photography and film, shooting film. And the one great thing that I can look forward to, because I don't know what's been lost at that museum in Sudan, but Amadeus, in addition to the film that he did, he has an art book of pictures that he took. And it's absolutely, I mean, words can't describe how beautiful this book is. And so a lot of the stuff that he took over there in Sudan, we will be able to use it in the future to document some of the things that were lost. And then it's up to other scholars, filmmakers, writers to follow up and use some of his footage to continue to document the history of Kush so that it's not completely lost.
Mm-hmm. If I can add on that point, you know, you open this segment with a libation, right? And one of the purposes of the libation is to call forth ancestors, to remember them so that they can live through us, so that they can inspire us. And you don't just call them just to participate in the ceremony, right? Just to impress people with your ability to pronounce names that people have never heard of. You call them because they have work to do. You call them because they work through us. So what you were just describing about what Brother Amadeus did during that trip in 2016 was really the ancestors working through him to document and to preserve their history. Mm. So that when those artifacts were destroyed, his documentation would last for all time, right? That's the continuum that can never be destroyed with any conflict, that can never be destroyed with attempts at erasure. You know, the work that we're doing, the conversation that we're having right now is about the perpetuation of the lives of people who lived 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 years ago. We're giving them life right now.
Correct. And what we're doing now is going to carry on to the future generations for those who are not yet born.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we in that context, we cry for Sudan. You know, I weep because of all of the people who's lost their lives or whose lives have been destroyed. All of the people, all of the fugitives. There's over 2 million fugitives. I weep for all of them. But and I also understand that we have an obligation and a responsibility to protect their ancestors, to protect the memory of their ancestors, so that their ancestral memory, the spirit of their ancestors, will continue to live for all time. So no matter where you are in the world, you can always be a part, you can always participate in this process of ancestral intelligence, the amplification of Sudan, the amplification of Kush, the amplification of Kemet, and Nilotic people. That's part of our legacy, and that's part of our responsibility. I just felt a compunction to share that, because I don't want our listeners to think we're just talking about old dead people. We're talking about a process where the dead can continue to live as long as we remember them, right?
And continuing with that tradition, you know, by honoring and talking about the people who are losing their lives and who are being, you know, there's actually a genocide that's being perpetuated in Sudan. It's been going on for a number of years. And so we, what the station is doing is bringing focus on these people so that their memory is not lost, so that we can honor them in the future as well, their sacrifices and their lives, so that people can remember them. But getting back to our trip to Sudan, one of the other things I that was very impressionable upon me was the Nubian people themselves. How you know, they just open up their homes, they open up their everything to us, you know, never seen any of us before, and just welcome into their house became our house. Mm-hmm. The hospitality, everything was just, it was so amazing. You know, as a musician, I remember one evening after we were eating, there was a brother who was playing some instrument, and we were talking about the music. You know, it's just so, and you could see the continuity in the culture, the musical culture. You know, it's just so much of our history is tied together. And I think the most memorable experience I had was when we were in the pyramid fields of Merowe, and we slept out under the stars.
Buddy, buddy, buddy.
You know, I always heard that expression, a blanket of stars in the sky or something like that. I could not believe how many stars were in the sky. You can actually see planets. You know, it just gave me a lot more insight into how this culture gave rise to timekeeping, calendars, you know, the whole bit, is because these people were able to study in that environment and dedicate themselves to building civilization. Mm-hmm. You know, it was very profound. It was a great experience. And then having the two older, well, I think I'm a little older than Renoko was. But to have
I think you're older than me. I'm older than Renoko.
No, you're older than Renoko, but you're older than me also.
Oh, okay. I'm the older then.
And but you know, to have you guys talk about the history as we were living through all of this stuff was also very profound. Mm. But it was a tremendous experience, and for me, coming from doing the dig, like just a week earlier, and seeing the excavations and how it was done, and the things that you were discovering in South Africa, you know, that just, you know, the whole thing was a mind-blowing experience.
Yeah. Thank you for that. Well, Amadeus, let me ask you, as a filmmaker, mm-hmm. As a filmmaker, as Amoye was describing that scene of the pyramid field at Meroway, you know, just hundreds of pyramids, right? As far as the eye can see, hundreds of pyramids. How did that image set in your mind as a filmmaker?
It was very hard to capture on film. The film doesn't, even with a wide angle lens, it's really hard to do it justice, right? Just the scope of it, the massive amount of pyramids, the difference in the pyramids from Egypt struck me. I think you pointed out that one of the pyramids that we saw was the pyramid that's on the back of the dollar bill.
Thank you. Let me put a pin there, because you only know what you know, right?
Yeah.
And I had always heard that the pyramid on the back of the dollar bill was an Egyptian pyramid. I wrote that in a couple of books because that's what I knew. But to go to Kush and to see the Kushite pyramids, the angle of the Kushite pyramids is steeper than the angle of the pyramids in Kemet. And so the realization of that really struck me, because when the Great Seal was created in the late 1780s, it meant that the people who designed that had to have known about Kush, right? And they were intentional about selecting a Kushite pyramid for the reverse of the Great Seal of the United States, as opposed to an Egyptian pyramid. So they knew something that they kept on the wraps.
Exactly. Yeah. Another thing that struck me was how detailed the art was, particularly in Naga, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, but on the side of the Lion's Temple.
Ah, yeah.
You see those reliefs, right? And it reminds me of the Old Kingdom artwork that we saw in Saqqara. How the Nubian art is incredibly detailed. The figures are a lot huskier and stockier than they are, you know, Egyptian art. They're a little bit more elongated, a little bit thinner. But the Nubian art definitely has a distinct flavor. You know, wider hips, wider shoulders. They're more robust. Highly stylized. I mean, the jewelry, the kilts. I mean, it's just incredibly detailed. So that struck me, and that let me know that they're, you know, that is definite proof to me that the two cultures are definitely connected and probably most likely come from the same origin, from mm-hmm. Upper Egypt and mm-hmm. and down into Ethiopia even.
Exactly. So it's Upper Egypt, upper Kemet, Upper Kush, and Lower Ethiopia, right? Where Lake Tana is, which is the source of the Blue Nile, which supplies 80% of the water that flows through from Khartoum north through Egypt into the Mediterranean Sea. So were it not for Ethiopia, there would be no Kush, there would be no Kemet. And as John Henry Clark often referred to the Nile River, he called it the world's oldest cultural highway. And we know that the people followed the flow of the river from south to north, and they brought their language, their art, their astronomy, their spiritual traditions, and everything that made them who they were. They brought it with them as they moved out of the highlands of Ethiopia, and the lowlands of Uganda, and just developed their personhood all along the entire 4,200 mile long length of the Nile River, you know?
I just want to add something to what Amadeus was saying, the stylized architecture that he was talking about, you know, during the so-called 25th dynasty, it was Shabaka and Tahaka that came through Kemet and restored a lot of those temples and things. So again, what we just was talking about, these people were restoring the works of their ancestors. That's the way they looked at it.
Exactly.
Restoring what was lost from their ancestors, and they made it available for us today.
So, and that's a key point. I don't want you to just gloss over that point. They restored in Kemet what they had retained in Kush,
right,
which to me implies that was the source.
Yeah, because that was the source. You know, both Shabaka and Tahaka referred to this is we restoring the works of our ancestors.
Exactly.
You know, and you know, you listen to the Egyptologists; they try to say that, well, you know, Nubia just assimilated into Kemet, and they, you know, they just borrowed everything from Kemet. Well, you know, these people have been intertwined; their cultures have been intertwined, mm-hmm, since the beginning of time. And they had, matter of fact, in the book that I wrote, I talk about like the Middle Kingdom, almost all, from the Mentuhotep, all of the people in his regime were mostly Nubians. And then you're talking about the 18th dynasty, those were mostly all Nubians. You know, their cultures have been intertwined from the beginning.
Your book just dropped a week ago, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
So tell us quickly about your book.
Okay, it's called Nasut Bidi, The Spirit of Our Ancestors, and it's the indigenous Black rulers of Egypt. The book is sort of like written in two parts. The first part of the book, I reiterated what was proven by Diop, Obenga, and John Jackson, John Henry Clark, you know, so many of our scholars, you know, have proved that Kemet was an indigenous Black African civilization. And so I just went through some of the points that was used to prove that, namely melanin studies, the cranial studies, genetic studies, and stuff like that, linguistic studies. So I outlined some of the key points of that. And then in the second part of the book, I think when we talked the last time, I remember growing up hearing that our people once were kings and queens in Africa. And I wanted to know more about who these kings and queens were. And so I decided to take 10 people and do short biographies, 5 men and 5 women. So we have the male and female energy. And I gave short biographies of some of these people and let you know something about their accomplishments and achievements and advancing the culture. And I also wrote a lot of metal nature because I wanted to expose the younger people, the younger audiences to want to learn the language. And what I originally wanted to do in the book is to have it used as a textbook. I'm a retired educator, and I wanted to write a book that could be used in education because I foresaw what was going to happen in terms of what's happening today with the, you know, they destroying our history, literally making it illegal to teach Black history.
Okay. Dismantling the Department of Education, if you will.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, so I wanted this to be a teaching guide, and I used as a model. Well, I attempted to use that. As I got into the work, it became, I just wanted to do it this way instead of my original intent. I wanted to do it like how you did your book, The Nile Valley Civilizations, where you had a textbook and a study guide.
Sure.
And the same thing that Robin Walker did with his When We Ruled is a textbook and a study guide so that people can actually use it as a curriculum guide in the schools and you know, teach children at different stages, you know, the history and how to use the materials and give them impetus to do further research down the line. So that's right. Basically what it is in a nutshell.
Cool. Thank you so much. Brother Amadeus, you've got 3 films. Where can people view your film work?
Yeah, they could view it. Probably the best place to get it is outofdarknessfilm.com. Outofdarknessfilm.com. You can get all three films there. Out of Darkness, the original one, came out 2016. Heavy is the Crown, Volume 1, came out 2022. And the latest film, Out of Darkness, Heavy is the Crown, Volume 2, just released last week as well, November 11th. All three are available on my site, and they're pretty much streaming on every major platform. We're going to make a big push around February for Black History Month, African History Month. Volume 2 can be streamed on Vimeo on demand if you just search Heavy is the Crown Volume 2. Yeah, so the photo book is actually called The Temples of Ancient Egypt Volume 1. In Volume 1, we have all of the photos from Karnak, Luxor, Hatshepsut's mortuary temple, Medinet Habu, Dendera, and Abydos are in that. There's going to be a second volume of that, and then most likely put out an independent one on Nubia with all the photos from Nubia. So that's going to be really special. I spent a good day of the today looking over the photos, and man, cool. it's like I said, it's very hard to capture, but I just shot everything that I saw and documented it.
Let me say this. You know, when I first met you, I knew you were an artist. So you actually went to school for filmmaking. You're not some brother who just picked up a camera and just started shooting and claimed to be a filmmaker. You are a filmmaker. Mm-hmm. And the quality of your films, man, the look, the color, the editing is top notch. I mean, it's the best I've seen in this genre. And I'm not saying that just to blow you up. I'm saying it because it's the truth. I'm an artist, and I appreciate good art. And you have produced an outstanding product. So I'm quite proud of what you've done. And I look forward to, working with you in the future. And Brother Moye, you know, as a retired educator, you understand how important it is that young people see themselves in history and know that their ancestors had a role in shaping history. We hear about disasters all the time. We hear about what we aren't doing. It's important to hear about and to see what we have done, because as Brother Renoko has said on numerous occasions, what you have done, you have the capacity to do again. So, you know, I want to thank both of you all for being with me to help amplify Sudan, to help amplify Nile Valley culture, Nile Valley people, Nile Valley civilization. Because with all of these wars, the physical wars and the psychological wars and the educational wars, we are under a full-fledged assault, a never-ending, a relentless assault against our humanity, against our right to tell our own story. So it's important that we have writers, it's important that we have filmmakers who are courageous enough to make sure that these stories of our ancestors are told. So both of you all have consented to stick around and go into the overflow room with me. So I'm gonna invite you all to sit tight for a minute and let me wrap up. Amplify something that you and Moye said earlier about the importance of setting aside this time, more than 12 hours to amplify Sudan for us to tell our story. And as I stated at the top of the show, we're in the season of giving. So whether you're going to be celebrating Thanksgiving, whether you're going to be celebrating Christmas and Kwanzaa and engaged in Black Friday activities come next week, don't forget
KPFT.
Don't forget those who sustain you and who constantly give to you. So you can still go to
KPFT.org
to make a pledge drive. You can use the
KPFT
app, this wonderful app that's been developed, to make a pledge to keep this station alive, to keep programming like today's programming accessible. It's part of the historical record. So people will have the benefit of listening to this entire day of programming from now on. So we have an obligation and a responsibility to make history, to document history, and to ensure that those who come behind us will be able to access the history that has been made. So everybody has a part to play. We all aren't just sitting back. We all may not be fortunate enough to travel, to visit these far-flung places, to do films or to produce books, but we can support those who are doing the work. And that's what's so critically important in this time of erasure. And if you don't realize that now, then shame on you. But if you do realize it, I want you to just understand what time it is. And we'll understand what time it is. So this is Tony Browder. This is Browder for our show. I want you to remember what Maurice White is always encouraging us to do. Remember that it's all about love, not that selfish love. It is selfish love.
You're listening to Tony Browder of the Browder Files, straight from a series of programs that ran on our sister station, WPFW, entitled Amplify Sudan. These programs highlighted some of the issues and challenges that Sudan is having today. Of course, we know that it's an oil-rich country. Tony Browder says that the history dates back. Sudan was ancient Nubia. Kush was a kingdom for over 1,000 years after the fall of Egypt. And their civilization lasted longer than ancient Egypt, whom we call Kemet. We hope that you gained something from this conversation. You're listening to Pan-African Journal. I'm Akua Holt. This is KPFT Houston. That's going to do it for Pan-African Journal. Thank you for listening. To find out more about Tony Browder's work, you can log on to WPFW.org and look for the Browder Files. His show airs on Wednesday at our sister station, and you can access it online at WPFW.org, and you'll hear some clips of his program right here on Pan-African Journal. Thank you for listening. I'm Akua Holt. Stay tuned for more on KPFT Houston. 90.1 FM.
Text and work. Text and pretend to work. Text and act surprised when someone calls you out for not working.
Who, me?
Text and whatever. Just don't text and drive. Visit stoptextsstoprex.org. A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
This is John Henry with Pacifica Business Talk. With all the things that are happening in the world today, sometimes you really want an escape. KPFT provides sanity with a great variety of music and talk 24 hours a day and 7 days a week. It's available online at kpft.org. You can just go there and press listen live if you're at your desktop. And you can become a sustaining member today. It's safe, secure, and easy to do. Just go to kpft.org or dial 713-526-5738. For all the times you want to get away, and for all the times that you smile and enjoy the music styles and talk on KPFT, call us now at 713-526-5738.
KPFT Programmer Profile.
Hi, this is Clint Broussard from KPFT's Blues and Hi-Fi. Basically assemble my show through my vast interest of blues. I try to broaden the spectrum of what blues is. I always say I try to take it beyond 12 bars and 3 chords. I'm very interested in sort of exploring the blues in every shade that it has to offer.
Listen for Blues and Hi-Fi, 5 p.m. Sundays on KPFT.
Hi, I'm Francesca Rhiannon, host of Writer's Voice. Coming up next on KPFT's HD2 channel, tune in as we talk to writers of all genres about matters both timely and timeless.
KPFT Programmer Profile.
Hey, this is Steve Gallington of the People's News.
What we do is we focus on local news and international news that is of interest to the community. And we're always looking for that next story. If you have a story, bring it to us and let us know, because this is your program. The People's News belongs to the people, and we want to hear from you. And you're listening to KPFT Houston.
Listen for the People's News Sundays at noon, Monday and Thursday at 9 a.m. on KPFT's HD2 channel.
Donating a car you don't need to KPFT is an easy way to help us bring your favorite music and news in crazy times like these. Learn more at kpft.org or call to donate your car to 1-855-